geeks and cinemaniacs. From the heart of Hollyweird, California, at the epicenter of all things eerie and awesome, it's time for Charles Band's Full Moon Freak Show.
This week, we welcome another buzz name in indie horror to the show, New England-born writer-director Joe Bigas. Joe first made a dent in the world of strange cinema with his 2013 sci-fi shocker, Almost Human, and followed that with his critically acclaimed exploding head saga, The Mind's Eye. Splatter-filled flicks like the punk rock vampire film Bliss and the epic survival shoot-em-up VFW starring Don't Breathe, Stephen Lang, and Fred the Hammer Williamson followed, leading to his latest flick, the carnage-filled Christmas slasher, Christmas Bloody Christmas, featuring a maniacal robotic department store Santa going on a bloody rampage. It's my pleasure to welcome this next generation horror helmer to the show. Hey, Joe.
How's it going?
It's going good.
Going good now.
That's good stuff. You've been at it, and you've been making some movies for, like, no dough.
Yeah. And finally have somewhat of a real budget, fifth time out.
So. Really? Okay. Yeah. Well, we're still making movies for no dough, basically. On occasion, we've had some real money, but for the most part, our movies are anywhere from, if I can say it, $70,000 to $200,000. That's kind of it.
Yeah. I've made a couple in that range. Three movies in that range under $200,000, yeah.
Okay. So tell us about those. Let's go anywhere you want. I know you started with a movie, what, 2013 was your first movie?
That's when it premiered, but we shot in early 2012. So okay. It's been a little over 10 years, actually, since we started shooting. And we've locked cut on my first movie on my birthday in 2012. So almost 10 years now, or a little over 10 years since I've had a locked movie. And then 9 since it premiered, 8 since it came out.
And that was called?
Almost Human.
Almost Human.
And that one was 50,000.
Perfect. I love that number.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you ever get bored in between your bigger flicks, now you want to come make a Full Moon quickie, give me a call.
Well, 200K ain't nothing to scoff at.
No. But we're closer to the other K.
Yeah.
The smaller K.
Yeah. I never know.
Well, that's great. So that kind of launched your whole shebang, right?
Yeah. It actually was very successful, but it's still been an incremental climb, you know. We made that for 50 grand. We got into Toronto Film Fest, which is like crazy. You know, my dad came up and we're at a bar and like George Clooney's ordering a drink next to us. I think that was like one of the times he realized, oh, wait, no, maybe this movie thing will work out, I guess.
That's so cool.
But we sold it for like 5 times our budget to IFC, sold it worldwide, and still had to scrape together the budget for my next movie.
Really?
Yeah. But I probably could have done something else, but, you know, I wanted to write, produce, direct my own thing do it from the ground up again. So back to ground zero, scraping money together.
So I've done that for 40-odd years.
Yeah,
so there's no mystery. So how long was it before you made the next show? What was that?
It was probably like 2 years. So we started shooting that in early 2015, and Almost Human came out early 2014. So it was about a year of putting that movie together and getting the money for it and eventually going out and shooting. You know, I wanted like $1 million for it, and we ended up shooting it for about $350,000.
So you got a third of what you wanted.
Yeah, which is actually part of the course for every single movie I've made. It's like, here's my budget, and then somebody's like, we'll give you this much.
Right.
I'm like, okay.
That's kind of how it works.
I should just double what I pretend like I want, and maybe I'll get my real fucking budget.
Yeah, you'll figure it out. No, you won't. It's just the way this thing flows. It's a crazy business.
Yeah.
But you have I don't want to get right to today because you have a big movie coming out in a week or days
week
from
and
now.
A half. Yeah.
So that's really, really cool. But so, okay, now you're doing your second show. So how did that go? What was that like?
It was crazy. I mean, so I made my first movie, like, just to go back a little bit, I made it on credit cards. So basically, like, I don't think I'm good enough writer to – it's like I was never going to sell a screenplay. I didn't have a lot of connections. I was actually interning for Stuart Gordon when I wrote my first movie.
Wow.
He gave me notes on the script. I was calling him, like, every weekend,
great.
And he was,
such
like, you know, giving me advice. On
such a loss that he's not around anymore.
You
know, he was a close, close friend. We made, as you know, many movies together.
I mean, yeah, he was my mentor. He's read every script I wrote for almost 8 years.
That's great.
Notes. Came to the screening with his notebook, yellow legal pad. I'm like,
wow.
Watch the fucking movie, Stuart. Stop scrolling stuff in your notebook. But yeah, I scraped together the money to make Almost Human. It was like $27,000 to get it in the can.
Right.
We drove back home, a bunch of equipment in my car, stayed at my parents' house, my producing partner's parents' house, cut the movie, used that to raise finishing costs, sold it. Then with our second movie, I was like turning down. I got erupted by a big agency, Paradigm. You know, thought that I was James Wan's agent. Thought I was like, you know, off to the races. But Turns out that wasn't the case. You know, there wasn't a market for a hard R scanners telekinesis
really?
Revenge movie. It's like Death Wish meets Scanners.
Right, yeah. Would have been different today, but nonetheless.
Yeah. So we scraped together the money for that. I got like 14 investors.
That's fantastic.
Went and made that movie, completely independent, produced it with my buddy again. Got into Toronto again, sold that to RLJ.
Oh, wow.
And then, yeah.
Is that the head exploding movie?
Yeah.
Okay. Anything with heads, I love. You know, I've made Shrunken Heads, Head of the Family. We're into heads that do weird things.
So yeah, yeah.
I love it.
The violent, you know, we had lots of head. We blew up I love in Maniac, the, you know, all-time head explosion right. Dawn of the Dead. So we actually, like, went out into the woods and built the end of a hallway and had a guy levitating up. My dad fucking, Josh's dad, my producing partner, actually blew it apart with a shotgun in the middle of the woods. So, like, we have the actual head explosion with a shotgun, which I'm very proud of.
Yeah, we've exploded some heads. Of course, you're a very young dude, but, you know, back in the day when Scanners came out, they briefly freaked so many people out because they were allowed to play that trailer and then an abbreviated commercial on television. And, you know, I'm used to horror, and I'm sitting there as a much younger guy in the theater, and the trailer comes up, and it's kind of cool and freaky, and then all of a sudden the guy's head fucking blows up, which no one had seen prior to that. That was like the first head blow. I mean, and it was really well done in slow motion.
Yeah.
So that's it's an homage to some degree, some of the material, I would assume.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have a quote on the poster that says, the best Scanner sequel we never got.
So that's great.
It's almost maybe too much Scanners, which I've, you know, in retrospect, maybe it was a little too.
Yeah, Scanners was like freaking 40 years ago or something, so that's all right. He's made a lot of wonderful movies since then. So that did well, right?
Yep.
I mean, that was good. And then the agency revved up and they gave
I fired them because they told me not to make Mind's Eye, and I was like, fuck this. And then I went and made almost made Mind's Eye. I got into Toronto again. Now I signed another
big
agency.
How do you do that? We've never done the film festival route because we're like, the minute the movie's done, we got to get it out and get our money because it's
– Yeah. Well, you guys have a name or a brand, so it's easier. Like I was nobody, and it's interesting because when I was growing up with DVD commentaries, like Eli Roth and Alexandra Aja, who did High Tension, they all premiered at Toronto Midnight Madness, and Gaspar Noé would premiere his movies there. And I was like, I just need to get into Midnight Madness. Like that's like how I launched my career. And the fucking movie somehow, they only picked 10 movies a year, and we got into Midnight Madness with the new Lucky McKee, the new Eli Roth. Colin Geddes selected the movie, and like he legitimately, we had nobody behind us. He actually must have watched every movie because he's like, I want to. He called me, and I remember I was driving to Burbank to a coffee shop, and I got the call, and I was like, one of those life changing ones. I'm like, oh my God, I'm actually going to be in fucking Toronto.
And Eli Roth, by the way, is a really cool guy. He was here a few weeks ago.
He's been very supportive too. Like,
he's great.
Met him there, and
great.
Told him kind of how Cabin Fever, his whole run.
So by then, did you make some money on any of these things? Enough that you got investors paid? You had some money on your own, or is it hand to mouth always? Or
Well, Almost Human made a lot of its money back, and because I was on credit cards, you know, owned a big chunk of that, so I was able to.
Clean up some.
Yeah, and I actually own all my movies,
Good.
Including the new one.
Dude,
which is,
I'm going to shake your hand. Because
besides VFW is the only one I don't own, but every other one I wrote, produced, own, and even on this, was able to get
them. Yeah, because at some point, you know, they need it for some years, you get the rights back. I mean, that's been my thing. It's the library has saved my ass, my because Full Moon has been up and down, and you know, we've great years and terrible years. So luckily, and especially as the direct-to-video market died, which it did, like one day Blockbuster and Hollywood Video were closed, gone. You know, it took a while before streaming started up, but luckily I held on to the library, and that is that's great that you're doing that.
Yeah, that'll be like in 15 years, you know, because that's like the license is now like 12 to 15 years.
Right.
So like when I'm in my 40s, you know, early 50s, I'll be like, all right, now I've got getting all my movies.
Let me
back.
Tell you something. I'll tell you how time flies. You know, we had many deals over many years, but in the early 90s, we were distributed by Paramount. And Paramount Home Video did a really great job, and it really helped take our weird movies. We're making one a month in 35, so it was, you know, a lot of heavy lifting. And a lot of those deals were 10 or 15 year deals. And when I signed them, and you know, they always try to push for perpetuity, is the worst word ever. Do not go for any perpetuity.
I've had that. If it's
because at the end of the day, you know, then they'll go, okay, 10 or 15, you resolve.
It's not a license if it's perpetuity. It's like,
no, it's yours forever. It's not a license. So I held out, and then it was like 15 years. I thought, oh, okay, in 1992, 2000, whatever. And all of a sudden, it arrives. Suddenly, it's like, oh, my God, I got 80 movies back because 15 years go by.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a good thing.
Yeah, I get my first movie back in March, actually.
Okay.
Surprising. That was only a 7-year license. So that,
like, which one?
Mind's Eye. So my second movie.
Okay.
So my mind's already running. Like, should I try and license it out to another company? Should I parse it out myself? Like, because I own it now. Or,
well, you know, the good news and the bad news. So the good news is you're getting your movies back and the world changes real rapidly in terms of rights. The bad news is the digital world is great with a library, and if you can latch or, you know, involve yourself with a streaming site. And the problem is, in the old days, not that long ago, if you made a movie, if it was the direct-to-video market, which was great for a lot of people for a while, you know, it was not all this bizarre math and views and streams and a nickel here and there. And it was basically you made, if it was the VHS days or the DVD days, same thing. You know, you shipped 40,000 units, whoever did, and it was an accounting. And if you were the distributor, which we were for most of the years, you get paid 60 days later. It was nothing complicated. And you could, if you made a movie for $200,000-$300,000 back in the 80s or the early 90s, you could, if it was successful and commercial, make a profit. Like, wow, I made it for $250,000 and I shipped so many units, and lo and behold, there's $400,000 back and I'll make another movie. It doesn't work that way digital. It's a different math. It's a different world.
Yeah.
So that makes it trickier. On the other hand, if you have the rights and you can get the right companies on board to license for another 10 or 15 years or 5 years and give you money, it's great. It's still a good thing.
Yeah, I've learned the advance. Just get as much, because I haven't gotten any fucking money back on any of the movies, even though, like, they're everywhere. You know, okay. It's like all of a sudden I've got movies on seven streaming services.
Again, only because I've done it for frickin' ever. You will never see a royalty once you get the advance. It just never happens. Unless you do your own distribution, that's another world. And I learned that in the 70s when you were like just a cloud somewhere in the sky. Because my first movies were all theatrical, B-side of a double bill, 35 millimeter. And, you know, I was dealing with some not terribly awesome and honest distributors, and they talk an amazing game. You know, oh my God, we're going to make a fortune together. And I was warned even back then, get a decent advance. Without the advance, you got nothing. And I got reasonable advances. Never ever in my entire early career ever got a penny beyond the advance, ever.
Yeah.
And then probably 7 years later, after I made, I don't know, 12 movies, by 1980, I made a movie called Ghoulies. I thought, okay, I got to get into distribution. This is still theatrical. This is kind of the beginning of the home video days. And that's what turned it all around. So if you want to be a prolific filmmaker, you got to find a way to get into distribution. Today's more difficult because of the streaming world. But yeah, you're not, if you get it in advance, if you get a royalty statement, consider yourself extremely fortunate.
Yeah, waiting. The budgets keep going up, so it's like, less and less likely it's going to happen.
It's not
going to
happen.
Yeah. So, but cool. The advances have cleared us pretty much on almost all the movies.
Well, that's right, great. No. You have a career rolling. So then what was the one before Christmas, Bloody Christmas?
Mind's Eye was my second movie, and that was 2015 we shot. And then my third movie was Bliss.
Which was
interesting because I actually went backwards in budget to like about $200,000.
Yeah, I never look at it that way. Some movies can be shot very inexpensively. They have less requirement, less days maybe, less location, less actors. So, you know, it ebbs and flows.
Well, what's interesting is my other two movies I shot in New England, Bliss I shot in L.A., and it was a super small crew. We shot on film, too, for $200,000.
What? You shot it on film?
I shoot all my movies on film.
What, 16?
Now. Yeah. So since Bliss, all my movies have been on film.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
And so we shot Bliss for $200,000 and, like, stole all these locations around L.A. and got this dope loft overlooking the city, and they were shooting Once Upon a Time in Hollywood at the same time. So, like, lead had a Cadillac, and I would strap 216 cameras to her Cadillac, and we'd drive through Hollywood when they were doing those shoot days. So if we ever got pulled over, it'd be like, well, we're doing second. We never got pulled over, but I mean,
second unit on.
That was going to be our go-to, but it never actually happened. So, I mean, we've got this fucking dope-ass Cadillac, and my lead's rolling around because it's a vampire movie with sunglasses. It's like 11 at night, smoking a blunt, covered in blood. I'm in the back with a 16 camera. There's another one latched.
And of course, you had all the proper permits, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we were good to go. You would think, and never got pulled over. And it's
lucky.
So because of all that and stealing all these locations and like shooting on film, all the reviews are like, Bigas finally has a real budget. And it's like, motherfucker, I had half of what I had last time. But that also made me learn because, you know, starting out in my head, it's like you always got to move up. But no, you just need to learn from your mistakes and figure out where you fell short last time. And budget isn't necessarily indicative
of
that.
And, you know, make it awesome and unique and entertaining because, you know, I mean, we all have seen recent $100 million movies that are, in my mind, unwatchable. They're just like, oh, please, really? We're doing this again?
Yeah. It's interesting you say that because, like, you know, I grew up on when your Paramount days. That's like when I grew up. You know, going to the video store, right. And I loved all those movies then. But like, you go back now, and it's like the direct-to-video market in the early '90s. They look and feel so fucking awesome because they're on 35mm. Yeah. And it's like the low-budget movies back in the day were 35mm with animatronics and matte paintings and fucking dope-ass locations. Yeah. And then $100 million movies now. It's like, why is the new Spider-Man movie shot in Atlanta? They have $300 million. Yeah. What the fuck are they shooting in Atlanta for?
There's a whole discussion about, you know, what CGI works, what it works for and what it doesn't. I'm not a big fan. I mean, some of it works pretty well, but, you know, there's something about shooting things organically in a camera, on film, you know. Yeah. So all our Puppet Master movies, all those movies, you know, we built the puppets. They're there. Actors aren't looking at a light, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's there fucking there.
And you could direct it. You can direct the material. You can't direct CG.
Oh, no, absolutely. So, you know, that's – look, a lot of money is nice once in a while if you use it wisely, but – everything generally, I think, today is overproduced. They spend too much money, and they kind of miss, like, stuff we care about, like characters and story and, you know, something different. It's like, I keep saying this, and I know people are going, oh, my God, he said this 100 times, but how many times can you watch a city get blown up, you know, earthquake, tidal waves, buildings falling, laser? It's like, oh, God, none of that matters anymore.
And the audience can tell if something's real or not. Like, Mad Max Fury Road was such a huge fucking hit because it's like, I think he's an audience member. You can tell that they're blowing shit.
Yeah,
people's lives are in danger. It's like, yep. I think these stuntmen are
also
fucking crazy.
Fun. It's a story. It was different. You know, you just got to – it's got to be – no matter what the budget, it's got to be character-driven. Otherwise, you just have a, you know, I don't know, a video game. So
– yeah.
All right. So, okay. So then – okay. Now where are we at?
Bliss. So I did Bliss, went back.
You can tell I'm a super student of these films. But, you know, just flowing here.
Yeah. Yeah. So we made Bliss, super low budget off the cuff. It had been a couple years since my last movie, and like I had other things that were maybe going to happen but didn't, you know, trying to chase that bigger budget. And
it's
just,
you know, the hard thing is, and you're doing everything that I've done forever. So you're inventing the project, you're finding the money, you're raising the money. I mean, luckily for us in the last X amount of years, we're self-funded. So, you know, we have money coming in and we keep making movies, you know. So I'm not out there with investors.
So do you like recycle like the money that comes in from your library? Does that go into feeding new
absolutely.
Movies?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's cool. All. Because I love making movies. I'm like a movie junkie.
Yeah.
So
that's my thing is it's like people are like, never put your own money in movies. They said that in my first movie. And I was like, well, you paid $200,000 for film school. I didn't go to film school. Right. So I'll put $25,000 in credit card to movies. And then guess what, motherfucker? I just made $200,000.
Right.
It sold for $200,000.
Right.
So.
Right. You know, it's an expensive art form. You know, my grandfather was a very well-known painter and sculptor. And what did he have to do to practice his craft? He had to buy clay or a canvas. We're no different, except this is a little more expensive than a piece of clay and a canvas.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing. You need to, I think, produce and conceive within your means and then be able to market it and get your money back at least so you can make the next movie. I mean, that's what it is.
And
few people do that. So, you know, kudos to you for doing the whole thing. I mean, a lot of people are there waiting the agent, the thing, the script, but you're actually finding a way to make it happen.
Yeah. And I think by nature of producing my own movies like that, it makes me a better director because I know where to put the money, like as a director, where I'm going to benefit from putting the money
here or
there.
You'll get pissed off at the director saying, what the fuck? Let's move on here. I want to go back to 16mm, which is a film. So, you know, all the movies I guess you saw of mine back in the 90s when you were a child, everything was shot on 35.
Yeah.
And I was one of the last holdouts. People were doing tape, and I thought, oh, a fucking tape, I hate it. And I kept doing 35. And then there was a while where you didn't edit the negative, which we always did. You would shoot it on 35 and transfer it to tape and edit the tape, which was a terrible period in a way, because when you go back to try to make a nice HD master, you got to go and you got to match cut the whole – it's a whole disaster.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a point where the technology got better and cheaper and, you know – I had to move over to digital. And I don't regret it. And, you know, you can do some pretty cool stuff. But it was all about money. I mean, at the end of the day, if there was no money issue, I would still be shooting on 35 because I love 35. I love the pattern of the look. Okay. So how does it work for you in 16?
The cutting-wise?
Well, and cost. I mean, it's still film.
Well, cost. So, like, on Bliss, I really wanted to shoot 16. I wanted to move into film. I just always loved film. I always wanted to. You know, I like digital has its place. I wouldn't have been able to make my first movie on film for sure. The fact that we shot on a Red camera that, you know, I borrowed from somebody, got that movie in the can, saved a lot of money. So with Bliss, like I was, you know, looking back and it was like, I have less money, but what can I do? And we kind of just ran the numbers and, you know, it cost back then in 2018, it was maybe like $40,000 extra to shoot on film for the purchase and the scan and all that. So it's about $40,000. And to me,
so you would scan on digital or whatever.
Yeah, or even now, because the prices in film have actually gone up.
So you're just shooting on film, and then you're posting on digital is what you're doing.
Yeah, okay. we go to Photochem, and they give us 4K scans on a hard drive, and then our assistant editor has to split it all up. But I mean, like, the 4K, it looks like a fucking film. You know, it looks like a 4K Blu-ray that was shot on 35. So our process is,
So you're shooting the whole frame, I guess, the whole...
Super 16, but my new one was anamorphic 16. On these brand new, like, super crazy anamorphic lenses.
Really? That's crazy.
And they're 1.2 speed, the 500T film stock. Like, it looks like early 90s 35 because... Wow. It's just the grain structure and the speed. It looks fucking awesome. That's the kind of 35 I like. Like a little bit of grain.
You need that. It's part of the magic. You know, now I see some of these older movies and 4K transfers. It's like, wait a minute. I never saw that pimple on that chick's face. I mean, it's like, what? You know, that's another conversation.
Also, that's what another thing with 16 is, you know, it gives a little bit of a little bit of a blurry sheen.
Which is good.
Because it's nice, some nice grain. And I also shoot a lot of low light stuff. So, like, it is kind of dark, and, you know, I start from a dark frame and then organically kind of place lights in there.
So what sort of – I know we're getting into technical talk, but I know a lot of people are into this, so we'll keep rolling.
I just want to convince people to shoot on film.
What is your ratio, 2-to-1, 3-to-1?
I honestly, like, we looked at our previous movie, Mind's Eye, that we shot on digital, and it was like, what was our ratio on that? And then it's like, let's budget for, like, 2/3 of that. So that we're not just getting one or two takes. I can kind of roll if I need to, but let's think about it. And we got through on mine, on Bliss, probably about that ratio. It ended up maybe being 1.5, 1.6.
That's pretty damn good.
So like I was never in a position where I'm like, oh, fuck, we can't shoot that. And you know, in my mind, I'm just like, fuck, if we go over, I'll buy the next roll. I don't fucking care. And something I did is it's also interesting because in the past 5 years, there's so few film cameras, nobody's actually manufacturing them. The prices have went through the roof.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
So I
mean,
bought,
rental prices?
Yeah, and per purchase because there's so few of them. And then like Walking Dead bought up a shit ton of them because that was on 16 to destroy them in stunts. So like there's just less and less of them. So I actually invested in a couple of packages years ago and they've went up 400% to 500%. So now I rent them to my own productions.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to start renting them. So it's like I actually –
good for
have now profited on the ownership of the 16 cameras.
You always do, but you're in such a rarefied area of this film universe because usually new gear, especially digital stuff, you know, 5 years from now, it's garbage. It's like, here's the new fandangled whatever the heck it is. Wow. Well, I'm impressed about the 16 millimeter deal and your ratio. For those of you who don't know, the ratio is if you have, let's say, a 90-minute movie – can you shoot it on 90 minutes of film? Well, no, because there are mistakes. There are several takes. So you go, well, if you shoot 2-to-1 ratio, that means you're shooting 180 minutes to cut down to 90 minutes. You're doing 1.5 times ratio, which means you're almost shooting every shot and taking maybe one more take and moving on, which is a discipline that doesn't exist anymore because people shoot on digital. I mean, my whole training was film. And, you know, 35 was expensive. And, you know, if we had – and we were buying short ends. I've talked about this before. So if you had 200 feet left, you knew it was about 2 minutes on 35. You had to kind of figure out, okay, that will work for the close-up of the thing and the thing. Bring out that 200-foot short end and you put the mag in and you'd shoot it that way. So we were very careful with minutes. Whereas today – and I think the discipline of being careful is, I think, helpful. Today it's like just let it roll. I mean they'll let – The digital thing, it's not even roll. All this nomenclature, like
record.
Just record. Let it record. And, you know, in between, shouldn't we cut? Well, it's okay. So it's different.
And it's interesting because that's how I learned. And then I went back to film. So it's not like I learned on film and then got the discipline.
I learned this the other way around.
Yeah. So, like, that's another thing with digital is I was able to, you know, you were saying how it's a little bit more difficult to make movies, you know, getting people together. But when I was a teenager, I was able to learn like by editing and or you know, my editing partner, my producing partner, like, but we were able to learn for next to nothing when we were in high school on those types of cameras. So like to me, that was big learning all that stuff.
That's cool. Then,
yeah, I make Almost Human and we're just rolling and rolling and rolling.
So you then were helping or assisting Stuart probably when you were a teenager or early.
I mean, 20. I moved out when I was 20 and started working for him like the first month.
Oh,
I was biking between Arclight, which is my first job here, and working for him full time.
So were you on Arclight as like an usher or what did you do there?
they just bounced you around. You would move around. I liked the Usher. They had an Usher monitor position where you would sit there to make sure nobody was talking.
Oh, I love
just
that.
Just watch fucking movies.
Shut up, fucker.
You yeah, know, yeah, yeah. Because I do that anyway when I pay to go see movies. Now I'm working at Arclight, like watching movies and then telling people to shut the fuck up. So like I was the best Usher monitor that they had.
Yeah. I'm the guy in the audience that does that a lot too. And it gets worse and worse. It hasn't gotten better. And once in a while, it's happened a few times where somebody near me was someone I did not want to tangle with, who was twice my size. They turn around and go, who are you shushing, motherfucker? And I'm like, oh, okay, and my shushing moment is over because these people are crazy. They go to the movie, they're on their phone. It's like, oh, my God. Yeah. So Arclight, it's gone.
Yeah, the Hollywood one is coming back
as
the Cinerama 14.
I hope so. Well, yeah. They pretty much invented the business where you could, you know, buy a ticket and have a seat. And
it just felt special going there. Always. Now it's like, you know, the new Spielberg movie comes out and it's like, oh, I guess I'll go to the AMC Century City or the Grove, which the Grove is like the worst audience imaginable. Like, because it's just people who are shopping, like, oh, let's go see a movie. And then you get the phones out. Yeah. Phones more than talking bother me because
it's the worst.
Screen.
The
so like, light. I actually sit up close
and
let the screen overtake me just by nature of no matter what, unless it's sold the fuck out, I'm not going to be seeing phones.
Yeah,
you know?
No, I can't handle that. It's really hard for me. I'm dangerously vocal about that shit. I mean, I used to back in the day, I shouldn't say this, but if you ever got something thrown at you when you're on your phone, it was probably me because I would throw shit. Because I mean, how can you be on your phone? And I'm the one who goes, turn your phone off. And I try to sound macho, you know, because I don't want to.
I can like feel my heart like racing.
Oh, it's terrible. It's fucking terrible.
But luckily, I go to I have a big group of peers that we go to the movies with all the time. And a lot of my friends, you know, like my producing partner, he's like 6'5. And my other friend is
like, with him.
You know, this 300-pound guy with a big beard. He's like, and it's like somebody turns around to say something. It's like, well, yeah, they might say shit to me, but it's like, I got two guys who look like bodyguards on either side of me, so I've got.
So when you were at the, I love this story. When you were at the Arclight, then so you were the guy who said, "Please, you turn your phone off or shut the phone." I mean, you had to
sometimes
be
that was the usher greeter. So they had an usher greeter, usher monitor.
Were you the guys who came out and said, "Hey, everyone,
usher
do this.
Yeah.
We have good sound. If there's an issue, give me a call."
Yeah.
Okay, you were that guy.
Sometimes it would rotate. Like literally, you'd walk in and it's like, "Today you're in concessions." It's like, "What the fuck?" Because that guy gets to go watch movies, and I'm fucking slinging popcorn for
you know,
hours.
People wonder why movies are. I mean, there's so many reasons why people are not going to the movies. I mean, certainly an older generation, and that factors into it because, the Arclight was special. And it was great that someone – I don't know if you looked that way with all the hair because, you know, you're a
– Not when I was 20, but –
That's what I thought.
For maybe like
a little more –
Since I was like 23.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Because, man, it's just – the Arclight – for those of you who don't know, Arclight was a real – it kind of started this whole thing with high-end screenings and someone like yourself would come out and explain to the audience, it's going to be great. There's an issue. Give us a call. Because how many times have you gone to a movie where the audio wasn't great? It was out of freaking focus. I would go, I don't know, 1 out of 10 movies, it's fucked up and you got to go. And it's not like there's a projection. It's like the old days. It's all automated, crazy shit. You got to find the manager. Manager doesn't know dick. You know, the whole thing is ridiculous. But the worst part today, if you do go out to see a movie and the Arclight has been gone, is like AMC. You know, now, I mean, you know, God bless them. They're going to hopefully keep things alive. But 15 minutes of commercials and they're banging you on the head.
It's 22 now.
Oh, 22. Oh,
so I've timed it out because I have the AMC A-list and I live close to Century City. So it's 22 minutes of trailers. Then like the Coca-Cola thing is about a minute and a half. And then the Nicole Kidman thing. So 26 minutes on the dot, you know, after your start time, that's when the movie started.
And I never thought I'd hate Nicole Kidman, but then she came out. Fuck you, Nicole. It's God damn it.
So
it's
at least
ridiculous.
Update the commercial or something.
You pay
point.
$15, $20 to have to spend a half an hour listening. And it's... It's really unfortunate. So that coupled with, you know, audience taste, coupled with movies that are not really being made, and if they are for an older audience, no one's showing up, coupled with this terrible experience and the, whatever it is, it's just, you know, and then you can buy a flat screen for $250 and, you know, and almost everything's coming out shortly thereafter or day and date.
Yeah.
So why would someone go through that torture and spend $100, $150 and half hour commercials and some idiot on the phone and, you know, all that stuff? It's unfortunate because going to the movies when it was a great experience and it was a great movie and it was a packed audience is a unique experience. And young kids today who've never been, they've never experienced that. I mean, I did. I went to so many movies back in the day and I went to The Exorcist the first day it came out and some of the great movies and The Shining and Apocalypse Now. And it's magic. You're there and the audience is super respectful and they're quiet. In the case of The Exorcist, people were like fainting and they were carrying them away. it was an event, and those days are really over.
Yeah, I mean, when I grew up too, I would spend the weekends with my dad, and Friday night would go to the video store, rent a couple movies, and then every Sunday afternoon we'd go see like the new movie that opened.
Sometimes you actually rented some of my movies, I guess.
Oh yeah, that's because you know when I was younger, you know I was like 5 or 6 in the early '90s, and Doll Man was like the first one that appealed to Puppet Master, but like then outside of that, like Doll Man. So like just when I, you know, my dad would let me rent a movie or two, and he was into horror, and my parents were super young, had me in high school.
Awesome. So he's like, I already like your parents.
Yeah, my dad's like 23, and we're going to the video store, and he's got like
23, and you were like 5 or 6.
Yeah, my mom was 16, my dad was 18.
Whoa.
Or 18. Yeah, so like,
dang,
I was a mistake. Thank God, you know, they decided to see me through. But
wow.
So like, I had really cool parents who loved horror movies.
Imagine if you had like a 7-year-old right now.
Well,
or an 8-year-old.
Yeah, I would be. My dad was my age. Or maybe a little bit older when I moved out to LA. So like when my dad was my age, I'm 30, I just turned 35. My dad was like 17. When I was 17, my dad was like my age. So like to think about myself having a 17-year-old,
I'm
like, what the fuck? I couldn't imagine some fucking kid like me, some fucking stoner coming in at midnight running his fucking mouth. But no, I love my parents. But like,
that's great that they allowed you as a young kid to see some of those movies.
Like, and I think it was just the nature of, you know, my dad trust, or I don't know, because he was so young, I guess, but like also the advent of VHS, my dad would tape shit on HBO and there'd be 4 movies. So like I'd wake up at 5 a.m. and learn how to work the VCR. It's like, oh, I'm going to watch Drop Dead Fred. And then next is Pet Sematary. And then next is, you know, fucking Basket Case. And then
so
next
you were
is Phantasm
just weaned 2. On this stuff.
Yeah, that was like my whole life. And my dad would get Entertainment Weekly and I would like read it and like look, I'm like 7, like looking at the box office numbers and the reviews.
So freaking cool.
And
that's awesome.
Yeah, so like when I'm in the video store seeing your stuff, like it's the covers that would appeal to me.
Thank you.
And Tales from the Dark.
You know, it all started with the covers for me.
Yeah.
I mean, because if you can't, you know, turn an audience on, in this case, an audience who looks at the cover of a VHS or a DVD with the art and the title, they're gone. You know, there's no pre-sale. No one knows about the movie. It wasn't released theatrically. It was just, so you're on that shelf and Terminator and Aliens and, ooh, look, Puppet Master. That looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
There's still people who, when I talk to, there's a lot of fans, they say that when they saw some of these movies on a video store shelf, they actually thought they missed them theatrically, so they rented the video. And none of those movies played theatrically. They all were premiered on video.
Also, the Paramount logo at the front helps.
Yeah.
And most prized VHSs when I was a kid was Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, which is a Paramount title. And I've probably honestly watched that VHS like 100 times, and the Crash and Burn trailer was in front of it.
Right.
And like the Crash and Burn trailer, I actually had to track it down on YouTube because it's just so ingrained, like the music and the robot.
Yeah,
and
it was pretty cool.
That was one of the first movies too where I was like, how do I see Crash and Burn? I was like, the robot coming up at the end and the fucking robot like at the end.
That was fun directing that.
I have the original theatrical one sheet at my house.
You do?
It's rolled up, not
Dang,
framed.
You should have brought it here. I would have like put a big smile on
it. Yeah, I would have had to dig it out somewhere.
Okay. Yeah. By the way, I should say, just because you mentioned Doll Man, that Albert Pune, who directed Doll Man and later directed Arcade, just passed away a few days ago. He was a very sweet guy and a real innovator. He had a great aesthetic. He was, you know, we knew each other back in the late 70s. He made a movie called The Sword and the Sorcerer for the same distributor who distributed some of my movies and never sent me any overdues,
yeah.
Of course. And then years later, we did a couple shows together. And it's sad that he is no longer with us because he was a cool guy.
Yeah, I did a double feature Saturday night after I found out the news of Cyborg and Arcade.
No way.
Yeah, so I had actually just recently watched Nemesis before my new movie just because of the robots in it. But Nemesis is like my all-time favorite Albert.
Yeah,
movie. But like it's weird because I feel like he used to get a lot of flack for kind of being like a, you know, kind of like a, it's so weird. Like you go back and you read older stuff, people are like, a current day Ed Wood. And it's like, no, motherfucker. Like the opening shot of Cyborg, that fucking matte painting, or like some of the stuff in Nemesis.
Awesome.
And it's like, dude,
you know,
this guy
was ahead of his times. It's that simple.
Well, he's getting a lot more respect now. You go on Twitter and it's like everybody's,
like, but back then he was not getting that respect.
I know. And it's a shame because.
And by the way, you know, I've, I don't know how to say this without offending anyone, but I was very enamored of Megan Ward. So Megan Ward sort of was discovered. She was the lead in Crash and Burn, the young pretty girl. And I thought she was just a magic. And she went on to have quite a career, and she did a lot of soap operas, and she's a great chick. But when Albert and I talked about doing Arcade, you know, he had some ideas. I said, look, we got to use Megan. You know, she's awesome. So she's the lead in Arcade as well. And anyway, Albert Pune, R.I.P., man.
Yeah. Great force of low-budget genre filmmaking.
But he made it – his approach wasn't a low-budget approach. He kind of was ambitious in the way he covered that stuff.
Yeah.
I said it earlier on a thing I did a few days ago. in Doll Man, because of the perspective, is all, you know, everything was in camera, all that forced perspective stuff, you know, so which I love. I've made several movies, more than several of that. I made a movie called Head of the Family. I'm not sure if you ever saw Head of the Family.
That's one of the ones where the cover was immediately like,
it's the best.
What the fuck? I'm going to watch this right
and
now.
And literally, there's not an effect shot in that movie. Not an effect. Everything was forced perspective. So we had the head and the sculpture, and of course, we had to build sets sometimes a certain way. And we used a certain lens, and the head was here. And if the normal sized people are back here, you have to figure out the eye line. And there's an organic quality that's freaking awesome. Now today you can do it easily with CGI, you know.
But also people will see that. But like also, I think that an element that's exciting to me as a filmmaker is that magic trick. Like, how am I going to trick the audience into?
Yeah.
Like, how am I going to figure out how to pull this off in a way that's going to sell it and trick them? I mean, like, they're so satisfying.
And also on 35 with that vibe that it had, if you know how to do this stuff. It, you know, back then the alternative was a matte. There was a different, you know, it wasn't CGI. It was another way to kind of combine frames. But it never looked that good.
Yeah, like a comp, an optical comp.
Yeah, it just never looked that good. So, yeah, I'm not sure why I'm talking about Head of the Family, 35, a big head, exploding heads. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. All good stuff.
Those are fun movies. So, okay, then what happened in your mad career so far?
So I made Bliss. Yeah. Also interesting, I wrote Bliss because I was like in a place where nothing I wanted to make was getting financed. So it's like it's a movie about a painter who is behind. She needs to deliver this painting that she got paid for. She gets into this crazy hallucinatory drug that spins her out of control. And then, you know, she has like this wild night with a threesome where she may or may not have been bitten by a vampire. And now all of a sudden
she's boobies and everything?
Yeah. It's
okay.
It's just very. It's again. It would be unrated, but it would have been NC-17.
Oh, really? Oh, it's that.
Yeah, it was very.
Okay.
Very cool. Sensational. Okay. But and then she starts, you know, hallucinating. But she figures her painting, and is she killing people or not? And I wrote that because, like, I was like, I couldn't get anything made. I was having trouble writing, and I'm like, I'm just going to write a movie that's angry about the art form and trying to do this. But instead of a white screenwriter dude in his shitty apartment, I'm going to make it this hot chick who's in this fucking downtown.
I got to see this movie for sure.
And she's drawing, you know, the painting's the size of this wall, and she's painting it. And she's like, at the end, she's just covered in paint, naked, painting it, and bodies that are coming and dragging up. And
Bliss, okay.
So like, yeah, that was me being like, I'm just going to fuck. I just, you know, I'm so angry. So I wrote it, got a couple hundred grand to do it, and then meanwhile, I was attached to direct. VFW and just waiting to like get cast. And I was like, told the producers, hey, I got this movie Bliss finance. I'm just going to go shoot it really quick. If we get the cast for VFW, I'll put it aside. We'll go make VFW and I'll edit it later, but I'm going to go shoot this movie. So I shot Bliss. We got it in the can. VFW ramped up. I was simultaneously doing post on Bliss with VFW pre-production, finished it in the nick of time, got into Tribeca Film Fest, which was during the VFW shoot, literally shot as the sun came up, Stephen Lang with a shotgun in front of a fucking exploding car as the sun came up, covered in blood, took the camera off my shoulder, got in a car, went to the airport, flew to New York, me and my producing partner, got there just in time for the pre-party, went to our Bliss premiere, partied all night.
Perfect.
Got on a plane the next day, flew back to Texas, slept, and then went back to shooting VFW. And I was like, and everybody was
welcome
like,
to the mad club.
Yeah, people are like, what is wrong with you? You're crazy. I'm like, what is wrong with me? I'm like, this is what I've. Right. I'm literally shooting a movie while premiering another one across the country. Like,
you're on the right track, and you know, this it's forward motion too. And, you know, never stop, because the minute you slow down and try to really think it through, it's like it's over.
Yeah.
You know, you just got to keep one inch ahead of the tidal wave of madness, so you can keep rolling with your movies. But you have a way that you've been able to finance your movies, which is rare, because most. You know, you have to be part entrepreneur, part magician, part huckster, filmmaker. You got to do all that to kind of make this work in the way you are, which is what I've done for my entire career.
Yeah. But I also like that because you retain more control. You know, for me,
for
it's
sure.
like,
besides,
you know, again, like the VFW is only my director for hire. The only director for hire I had, every single one I generated from a blank page, and I've had Final Cut and all those.
Good.
Full control over casting, everything. And it's like.
No one ever hired me. Not once.
Well, I'm never going to do it. You know, that was my one thing to see how I liked it. And it was fine. You know, I got to work with some great actors and stuff. But, like, it wasn't the same as creating my own thing and having full control.
And so now you got to tell us about the movie coming out in 10 days or whatever it is.
I guess 10 days, December 9th. So Bliss and VFW came out simultaneously had a lot of buzz. And I was like, fuck, now I'm finally going to get money to make another movie. And that they came out. VFW came out actually at the ArcLight. It was the last movie to play at the ArcLight on 35mm.
No.
We had Prince struck.
Oh, you had Prince?
Yeah, I print all my movies.
Oh my god, dude!
So we had a Prince struck, and Arclight was like, we'll book the 35 millimeter Arclight Hollywood. So they booked it full run for that week. And then COVID happened like 9 days after it came out. No. So I had these two movies that just hit and I was like, fuck, I'm on the top of my game. COVID hit, shuts everything down. And it's like, whew.
Oh, man.
So
then began.
Yeah. Like, then like a year went by and I just, you know, started fucking around and started shooting a movie during COVID on film that's not done yet because the Christmas movie happened that I'm finishing shooting this month. But like the way that the Christmas movie came about is right before COVID, when these two movies came out, the rights holders to Silent Night, Deadly Night reached out to me and they were like, do you have a pitch for Silent Night, Deadly Night? We have the rights. We want to go right away. Right. We've got financing. So I love the iconography of that movie. I love the idea. I love the title. I think it's really ripe for a remake. And Terminator is my favorite movie. So right. One night, like when I'm trying to think of my idea, I'm, you know, sitting in my apartment stoned watching movies. And I'm like, what the fuck can I do? What can I do to like, oh my God, what if I made it the Terminator? Like, right. And then Silent Night, Deadly Night 5 has some robot elements
in it. So is Santa the Terminator?
Yeah, it's an animatronic. It's like a state of the art. It's so funny. We have like a fake commercial at the beginning, but basically it's like they took all this $1 trillion defense stuff from the government that was never used and like wartime stuff and repurposed some of it. And now they have animatronic like state-of-the-art Santas like in malls and shit. And one of them reverts back to its defense
That's
department hardware
and
just comes alive.
You know, we share that in common because I made a movie called Trancers many years ago.
Fucking love Trancers.
And there's thank you.
That's Tim Thomerson, man.
And Helen Hunt for the first movie. And in, there's a great scene in there where Santa becomes a trancer and fucking starts destroying shit and Jack Death kills him. And so we both have a bad Santa.
Yeah. Love that set piece too. So. But the Silent Night, Deadly Night rights holders were like, what the fuck is this? This isn't Silent Night, Deadly Night. This is too different. The fan base is going to be upset. And I'm like, well, I am the fucking fan base. Right, and they, trust me, people don't want to see the plot line. Yeah, that's not why they're coming to see Silent Night, Deadly Night. So then COVID happened and you know, and when I was bored, I was kind of like, they're right. This is really different. I mean, they didn't pay me to come up with this treatment. I guess I own the idea. And I fucking beat out the script really fast. I had a really detailed treatment. And it got financed pretty quickly.
Wow.
And it actually got financed by the same financiers, different producers, but same financiers who were going to finance Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Perfect.
But they financed my original movie at twice the budget.
Wow.
As an original movie.
So you had dough.
Cut out the middleman.
Good. I mean, did you go home at the end of the day and go, I actually have some money left over making this thing. I got a little money in the bank. As we said in the old days, fuck you money. Did you have some?
No. I mean, it was definitely – I got my best paycheck to make a movie because
it was
relatively budget.
Which is going to be turned into another movie.
But we came in right – like it was close to the budget. Like, I mean, so we had a couple million bucks, 2.5.
Whoa, that's like a
but
ton
we
of
shot
money.
For 43 days.
43
on,
days.
On film. We staged a blizzard. Complete blizzard. This movie has every frame outside. There's heavy snowfall, snow on the ground.
Okay.
Blew up four cars, had a car chase, built a fully working animatronic robot that we shot for 9 days. Multiple kills, multiple sets, built record stores. Like so, and then we shot all of our titles optically. So like, I mean, we stretched the fuck out of that. But it's a $10 million movie.
It's amazing how $2 million can go pretty quick if you are ambitious.
Yeah. And it it's our line producer's like, you're fucking crazy. What the, how you? And it's like, but we got it in and
that is great.
You know, I broke my fucking, I feel like we broke ourselves with our 9 month turnaround.
Yeah, but you got something cool coming. So it's going to be released theatrically then, right?
Yeah, they're doing, basically it's going to be everywhere that you can possibly find it. So Shudder was a co-financer on the movie.
Okay.
So it'll be on Shudder on December 9th. But RLJ also co-financed it, and they're going to put it on all digital outlets in 4K and special features, iTunes, Amazon, but they're also doing a nice theatrical push. We don't have a final list yet because they're still negotiating and stuff, but the day and date thing is harming us a little bit, but we still got like almost 300 theaters. We've got Cinemark on board, so it'll be at Cinemarks everywhere. It'll be at independent theaters. So like at least there should be somewhere that somebody could see it theatrically within 30 miles.
That is so cool. Good for you. So this is an interesting – I mean, first, I love talking to you. A lot of things in common. But the trajectory of your 50 grand first movie and, you know, how you had to kind of invent your way through money and hassles and all the shit we go through.
Yeah.
But controlling your own destiny. And here you are probably – I would say in my estimation, this is the end of your chapter one.
I hope so.
It is because now you're
– It's a decade. I look at it like a decade.
You've made a $2 million movie that's going to get a pretty good exposure. I'm sure it's terrific. The idea is great and it's going to be even more awesome.
Yeah, and I'm hoping because the Christmas thing, we get a lot of people watching it. You know, there's like a 16-day window where it's going to maximize.
You know, people who are showing up to movies are kids who want to either see the next Marvel movie – or some freaky, weird horror film. I mean, look at what's been performing. You know, kids want to go out with, you know, on a date or have fun or whatever the hell they're doing. You know, older people, first, not many good movies are being made anyway for an older audience.
Yeah.
You know, gone are the days of the 70s and the 80s and Scorsese and The Godfather. You know, those days are gone. I mean, maybe they'll come back, but if they do, they'll come back at home on your big flat screen. I don't see those people going back to the theater. But, you know, I'm rooting for movie theaters to survive, but, you know, I think you got the right movie.
Yeah. And horror, you know, it's hitting at the right time because horror is so fucking hot this year. It's like exploding. It's like, and I feel like you can look and there's waves too where like there's pockets where it explodes big time. And I feel like it hasn't happened in my career.
Right.
I'm always waiting for that like early 2000s pop
or
like that late 80s. And
now
it's like, okay, thankfully I've got a movie in the can.
And you got the right movie at the right time. So in my, you know, I've done horror movies for 47 years. Imagine that.
Yeah.
Way longer than you've been alive. And there are times when horror was not, or horror's always been pretty good. There's always been an audience. But there were moments when people would say, you know, horror is not happening. It's never going to come back. No one gives it, no one wants to see a horror movie. But
yeah.
Here it is, boom, where we're in a new.
Yeah.
And you need something different and clever. You know, I think your idea is great about the animatronic Santa. It sounds great.
Yeah, and it's old school, like, you know, inspired by the Empire stuff. Like,
thank
I mean,
you.
Dude, we had a fucking literally, you know, robot, $250,000 robot that has fucking eyes and it's, you know, remote controls.
Right.
And we're having it covered in water with sprinklers and putting explosives on it. And it's like shooting on film. And it's like, you know, this is.
That's great.
How
Stuart would be very proud.
I know.
He would. You know, he and I cobbled together a movie that was not inexpensive for us back, I don't know, way too many years ago, called Robot Jocks, which really was the first battling robot movie. And I'm really proud of it because that was all practical.
Yeah.
Today, all the recent Godzilla versus the whatever all these movies are, they're all CGI and they look cartoony to me. But Robot Jocks, it was not a CG, didn't exist. It was
so would you do like rear projection with the actors in front of and stuff like that?
That and the miniatures, some of them were almost as big as this room. I mean, we had big, they're still miniatures, but a lot of stop motion animation, you know. I mean, it plays really well for a movie made with not that much money.
Yeah, that stuff's so cool. I've experimented a little bit with stop motion animation, animation on my new, like, shooting actual on film stuff, like all that stuff. I just love.
We have a big one coming out that's taken over 30 years to make, believe it or not, called The Primevals. And that's something that you'll hear about soon. I'm not supposed to talk about it because we're also, in this case, doing something abnormal for us. It's going to have a theatrical release. We're doing something a little different next year. But it's like a Ray Harryhausen movie. It's like Jason and the Argonauts. That's the vibe of this movie.
And it was that's someone that I think I heard you talk about on another previous podcast. Like
David Allen was
the movie shot, and it's just the miniatures are a little bit.
It's not motion. We're done. We literally as of last month done. It's just going through post now.
So you went back and had to shoot the additional.
Yes.
Did you shoot it on film?
All film.
Oh, so even the new stuff.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
No, we had to stay true to, you know.
You're still shooting on film.
Yeah.
How did it feel to have that 35 camera roaring again after all them years?
Stop motion is like, okay, so you're lucky if you get 5 or 6 seconds every 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that. So you do not burn up a lot of film.
Yeah,
it's not like a thing. Hey, I wanted to give you something since your career, there's a lot of similarities. This is a book that HarperCollins published late last year called Confessions of a Puppet Master.
Oh, okay.
And you'll see similar stories than what you just described, because this is kind of my stories up to a year ago so far. So here it is. Just wanted you to leave with something.
Oh, thank you so much, dude.
You're welcome. And there's some fun stories about a lot of the movies we talked about, Crash and Burn and Head of the Family and Arcade and all those films. And dating back to all the Empire movies, Ghoulies and From Beyond and Reanimator. And so good luck on the Christmas show.
Thank you, man.
You know, seriously, send us when it's ready to roll. Send a trailer or something, and we'll publish it because we got a gazillion people watching this.
Okay.
I'd like to spread the word for your end of chapter one movie.
Fuck yeah!
All right, dude.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank
so much.
You very much, Joe.
Appreciate
Good luck.
It.
All right. Ciao. Okay, that's it for this week. Remember to follow the Freak Show for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from, and be sure to watch our video version of the show on Full Moon Features and Full Moon's Amazon Prime channel. See you dudes next time.